listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
BRICS has emerged as an important bloc in world affairs, and it's an important bloc for the global south.
That was the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, as he closed the 10th BRICS summit, which took place in Johannesburg, South Africa.
We, as South Africa, are very fortunate to be part of this club of countries that are charging ahead to promote growth of their economies, but also to promote a very progressive multilateral global system.
For more on all of that, we spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the well-known historian and author, about the potential of BRICS for changing the world. We spoke with Dr. Horn via Skype Tuesday.
Well, first of all, this meeting in Johannesburg, South Africa, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, the 10th anniversary of this organization known as the BRICS, was perhaps the most significant meeting on the African continent since 1958, when Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana organized a Pan-African meeting that set the stage for the independence of a number of African countries in 1960, then in 1963. I say this in part because there was also a kind of BRICS Plus meeting, that is to say, a slew of other African nations were present at the head of state or head of government level, in addition to Jamaica representing CARICOM, the Caribbean community, which, of course, as you know, includes Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, Haiti, etc. In many ways, there was a merger of the BRICS agenda with the African development and Caribbean development agenda. You know, I'm sure, that China has played a major role in African and Caribbean development in recent years, including building a north-south highway in Jamaica, building a train in Kenya that goes from Nairobi, the capital, to Mombasa, the Indian Ocean coastal city, in addition to building a train in Ethiopia that has helped to propel that economy forward. And there is also a BRICS bank that is a challenger to the World Bank in terms of that kind of infrastructure development. And I think that you can expect a lot of negative propaganda with regard to BRICS going forward, because I think that we're living through a transition, that is to say, the incipient decline of U.S. imperialism, not least because it's of its misdeeds, and the rise of Asian nations in particular, that is to say that the so-called American century is coming, fortunately, to an eclipse, not a moment too soon. And when you have this kind of transition, when you have the birth of a kind of new world order, although not what George H.W. Bush envisioned when he uttered that phrase some 25-odd years ago, inevitably there's going to be a kind of disruption, a kind of pain. And what I found striking about the BRICS meeting opening on July 25th, 2018, was that almost at the precise moment, on July 25th, 2018, you had the U.S. President, Donald J. Trump, meeting in the Oval Office with Jean-Claude Juncker, the head of the European Commission, the executive arm of the European Union. And in some ways, Mr. Trump was running up the white flag, because keep in mind that his previous grand strategy, as not necessarily as articulated, but as executed, was to weaken the European Union, to attack Chancellor Merkel, to try to split France from the European Union. That has been a press report in The Guardian of London, to turn Canada into a kind of vassal state, to neutralize Russia, and then to confront the big enchilada, which is China, and the smaller enchilada, which is Iran. That particular strategy, as executed, came under a firestorm and a hailstorm of criticism, particularly after the Helsinki summit. And by meeting with the head of the European Commission in the Oval Office and then having a press conference where he suggests that there has been a kind of peace offering between the two, Mr. Trump seemed to be backing off that strategy and going towards the traditional Democratic Party strategy, as articulated by Hillary Rodham Clinton, which is to unite with Canada and Europe against Russia and China. Now, from our point of view, both strategies are harebrained and doomed to defeat, but in any case, they represent this conflict at the highest level of the U.S. ruling class. And I'm afraid to say that some of our friends on the left have not thought through carefully what I've just put forward and have tailed after the Democratic Party, which I'm afraid to say has been a tendency of the U.S. left for some years now. But I think it's long past time for our friends on the left to take a very objective and careful examination of the global correlation of forces, and having done so, to articulate their own particular grand strategy. And when that process is completed, I'm sure that the BRICS will have pride of place, that it will be considered a keystone of a new U.S. left grand strategy, along with the allied organization, which is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a counterpoint, of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization led by the United States of America, and whose existence also represents this incipient shift in the global correlation of forces, with consequences that are tremendous with regard to the trajectory of U.S. imperialism and to the day-to-day lives of people who now reside in North America.
You know, watching this whole thing develop over the past years in particular, again, this is the 10th anniversary of the founding of the of this BRIC and then BRICS configuration. There's some interesting parallels to the rise of a new order with Chavez, really, probably in the Western Hemisphere, where China was encouraging this on a global scale, although nowhere at the level that this has been happening in the past maybe 5 or 6 years, where people were looking past the political systems that existed domestically to the obvious economic benefits of cooperation and the obvious political benefits of cooperation in terms of defense of their mutual sovereignty. And so I was really curious to see, with the coup that took place in Brazil, whatever you want to term the removal of Dilma Rousseff and the installation of polling now at 2%, Michel Temer as president, what kind of a stand we were going to see take place by Brazil at this conference. And likewise, the situation in South Africa has also been less than stable. And I thought perhaps we were going to see, you know, there maybe the U.S. was behind, certainly in Brazil, behind some of the changes at the summit of the governments, that we were going to see this expressed in some kind of hostility towards the BRICS, that the way we've seen in, say, Mercosur and some other organizations in Latin America. And in fact, the opposite seems true. It seems that the acknowledgement, regardless of which clique is in power in these countries, that this is a very powerful and potentially powerful grouping that is riding history forward, was in everyone's mind, regardless of whether they viewed each of the other people at the place as a political ally.
Well, it sounds strange, since we're talking here in the United States, but there is a principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states, which is routinely ignored in the United States of America. Not necessarily the case outside of the United States of America.
Right. You might have to actually repeat that in the United States just so it cuts through the atmosphere, because it's not used to being expressed.
Right. And so it's apparent that the partner nations of Brazil feel that the internal situation in Brazil is for the Brazilians to sort out. But having said that, I think that all of us should be concerned about this Brazilian election that's just around the corner.
Oh, for sure.
And the fact that, number one, a possible victor, Mr. Bolsonaro, is, in the words that Steve Bannon, the former Trump advisor, might put forward, he was Trump. Bolsonaro was Trump before Trump was Trump. That is to say that he is a neo-fascist. He is very close to the military, which is rather eager and anxious to leave the barracks and to do what they did a few decades ago, which is to play a more powerful and potent role in a civilian government, a process that you may recall led to the torturing of a young Dilma Rousseff, the president whose removal a year or two ago is what you were just making reference to with regard to what could fairly be called a coup that was not a coup. Mm. And the jailing of the person who in some ways is still ahead of the polls. I'm speaking of the former president, right, Lula da Silva.
That's right.
And it would be quite striking, remarkable, if he were able to get on the ballot and then win while imprisoned. I assumed he could pardon himself, to use the lingo that's now current in North America. But we'll have to wait and see. But in any case, bringing up that particular issue also raises another troubling concern about the internal politics of BRICS, because having these right-wingers sit at the table with President Xi, President Putin, et cetera, in some ways gives Washington a direct pipeline,
right,
to the inner councils,
right,
of the BRICS meeting. And that's something that's obviously of concern.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at those kinds of contradictions everywhere. When you see a sale of S-400s, for example, to Turkey, maybe the U.S. is openly feuding on television with Erdogan, but now suddenly NATO has some working S-400s, and it's like that across the... Just before we get deeper into where you're going towards the BRICS, on the question of... the relationship of fascists in Brazil to Trump at home. You know, we should remember that Dilma Rousseff was entirely removed. That entire process was closed on August 31st of 2016. That was before the presidential election. And so the installation of the people, both the actual fascists who are waiting in the wings and the ones who took, who engineered the coup in Brazil, in coordination with the ones that still have control of the military, was entirely a project of the Obama administration. I don't want to get away from that point before we go in deeper.
And likewise, for, needless to say, the terrible NATO bombing and invasion of Libya in 2011,
right,
which not only has turned Libya into a state of chaos, but it's converted into a kind of gateway, right, for Africans to try to escape across the Mediterranean, drown as a result, and then become object of derision upon landing in Italy, and used as a kind of punching bag,
right,
so that neo-fascists can come to power in Rome.
Yep, and also in installing AFRICOM, too, was the gateway for that, too. It was all kinds of things came out of Libya, that's right.
Right. And so when Mr. Obama made that speech on Nelson Mandela's birthday or thereabouts in Johannesburg, just before the BRICS meeting, he really should have fallen down on his knees,
right,
and asked for forgiveness,
right,
which I'm sure it would not have been given, for helping to turn the African continent, or at least the North African nation that is Libya, into a state of chaos. But back to BRICS.
Yeah, yeah.
Another issue that we have to keep a close eye on is this conflict between India and China.
Yes.
This could be the defining issue of the 21st century, because it's apparent that this small planet is reverting to small d democracy, whereby the two most populous nations on planet Earth no longer punch below their weight, and Washington, just like it tried to stir up conflict between Moscow and Beijing some 45 odd years ago,
right,
with Nixon's trip to China, which had decisive impact, I would argue, in terms of the Soviet Union's collapse on December 25th, 1991. And now Washington is trying to stir up conflict between Delhi and Beijing.
Yeah.
The Pacific Command has been renamed the Indo-Pacific Command.
That's right.
That's part of this encirclement of China. There are these constant conversations on a military level between and amongst the United States, Australia, and India and Japan.
Yeah.
And likewise, in terms of, since personnel is policy, it's quite striking that Harry Harris, who was slated to be an ambassador in Australia, was actually moved up to be an ambassador in South Korea. And I have to say, and Harry Harris, of course, is a preternatural hawk, U.S. military hawk,
right,
very anti-Beijing. And just perhaps a trivial note, but in interest of full disclosure, I'll mention it because it has attracted attention in Beijing. The surname notwithstanding, he's of Japanese ancestry, and of course, Beijing, that scene is not coincidental given the historic conflicts before 1949,
right,
between Tokyo and the Chinese Communist Party, for example. But in any case, this stirring up a conflict between New Delhi and Beijing, hopefully it will end the way the Moscow-Beijing conflict ended, because the payoff to Beijing was massive direct foreign investment that has helped to create this juggernaut,
right,
that bids fair to leave the U.S. imperialism sprawling in the dust, which has now ignited a trade war,
right,
with consequences so tremendous they're difficult now to contemplate.
Right.
Presumably, as part of the payoff to New Delhi,
right,
there'll be further massive direct foreign investment into Asia, into India in this case, which will leave U.S. imperialism further sprawling in the dust.
Yep.
But in any case, this conflict has to be monitored very closely. You recall that in 1962, There was this border war, as it's been termed, between India and China, with India coming out second best.
Right.
And India supposedly is not happy about expanding the ranks of BRICS because it feels that any new members or associates or affiliates will be pro-Beijing. On the other side of the coin, Beijing is supposedly and reportedly not eager to expand the ranks of the United Nations Security Council to include India because it feels that that will somehow raise the profile of India to the detriment of China. So in any case, this is a very important relationship that has to be monitored and surveilled very carefully.
Yeah. So, you know, if you look at the statement that was issued, before we get there, because the importance of this statement carries forward also, the next BRICS conference is set for Brazil. And in the same way that the conference in South Africa incorporated, outreach to Africa generally by the BRICS countries, and, you know, particularly in this case, we're talking China, but generally, the grouping focusing on Africa, on helping to do development of infrastructure, and there were a number of things that were stated here. The same, you know, take the show on the road, next stop is Latin America. And they're going to be, you know, looking to do that. And some of the things in the statement this time, we're talking, these are rather assertive things for a group that's not controlled by the United States on the world stage. Strengthening multilateralism. I mean, that goes right in the face of the hegemonic model that has, you know, held sway for decades anyway. Reforming global governance and addressing common challenges. All of those things, you know, pertain to this group in particular, but to almost everyone in the world outside of the U.S., EU, Japan and South Korea, strengthening and consolidating BRICS cooperation in international peace and security. Sounds like an assertion of, we're going to have a role in the way things get settled in this world. And then finally, BRICS partnership for global economic recovery, reform of financial and economic global governance, and the fourth industrial revolution.
Well, also keep in mind that this meeting in Brazil, as your comment has suggested, will also provide an opportunity for Latin American consolidation. And in that regard, I would like to refer listeners to this rather hysterical article that appeared in the New York Times a few days ago about China's role in Latin America. Usually these articles about China and hysteria focus on Africa.
Right.
Because, as you know, the North Atlantic nations see exploiting Africa as their exclusive preserve,
right,
so to speak. They're well aware that because of the African slave trade in particular, the system of capitalism itself was propelled.
Yep.
And so therefore, exploiting Africa is very near and dear to them. And so when China arrives on the continent, they get concerned. But now, U.S. imperialism is also concerned about China's role in what it considers to be its backyard. And I would point you to Chinese investments in Bahamas, just off the coast of South Florida, for example. I've already made reference to the Chinese role in Jamaica. There was concern in the New York Times article about this space entity that's been placed in Argentina that China sees as being key to some of its space initiatives going forward in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
We already know that with Mr. Trump's trade war, the soybeans that U.S. Midwestern farmers formerly sold to China will now be constricted, and China will be buying more soybeans from Brazil, which will strengthen the ties between those two nations, which are very complex and significant. And we haven't even talked about China's role in Cuba, the Isle of Freedom. And so this BRICS meeting in Brazil, I dare say, will mark a further consolidation of the relationship between China and the United States of America after President López Obrador takes office on December 1st. I'm sure you'll be able to include Mexico within this kind of initiative that I'm now are articulating, that is to say, as a key trade partner of China, particularly since Mexico is now part of the so-called trade war, that is to say, tariffs being slapped on Mexico and Mexico retaliating, not to mention the fact that on the Texas-Mexico border as we speak, a major human rights crime is unfolding in terms of snatching babies and children from the arms of parents as they try to seek asylum in South Texas, which has outraged Mexican public opinion, and I'm sure will lead to a muscular response by AMLO, the incoming Mexican president, when he assumes office on December 1st. So in any case, this BRICS meeting, I dare say, will be another important turning point in terms of the declension, the decline of U.S. imperialism.
You know, and then in addition to that, there's been a, I guess, a list, an inventory of projects in various stages of planning, major infrastructure projects that, you know, build the infrastructure out essentially for relations between China and, you know, the whole Belt Road project and Latin America, beginning with, say, the Nicaraguan canal and the cross-continental, transcontinental railroad in South America, deep water ports up and down all of the coastlines, essentially, that would allow a major intensification of trade. In other words, the infrastructure for major intensification of trade and two-way trade, because China has been talking about and doing some work towards developing not just we'll build the stuff here and you buy it, but we'll build factories there so you can, their win-win idea is we help to enrich our customers so they can afford to do business with us, which is an entirely different model than the West has used towards Latin America and Africa and elsewhere.
Well, of course. I mean, my very presence in North America is a symbol of the rapaciousness and the crude exploitation with which the North Atlantic countries has approached other continents. For those who may not be aware, I'm of African descent, a direct lineal descendant of the unlamented African slave trade, which snatched millions, particularly the young and the healthy, from the African continent and brought them to the Americas, particularly North America, to work as enslaved labor. And then, after international pressure from British abolitionism and the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, helped to ignite a civil war causing the abolition of slavery, then a hellish apartheid was then foisted upon the black citizenry of North America. And now, of course, we're going through another set of travails with hashtag living while black, breathing while black, sitting in Starbucks and being rousted by the police, right, barbecuing in the Oakland Park and having the police called upon you, and moving into an Airbnb rental and having the police called upon you, the actor Ving Rhames in the new Mission Impossible Tom Cruise flick, having police come into his home in Santa Monica and point
a gun at him. Yeah, he said, "I saw a red dot on my head," he said. Yeah, nice.
Exactly. And so this chain of historical events that I've just sketched is an emblem of how the United States has dealt with other continents and how the North Atlantic nations themselves have dealt with other continents. And it's rather ironic that Britain now is going through this sort of slow motion decline with Brexit, with all sorts of nightmare scenarios perhaps erupting as soon as next year with this crashing out of the European Union, possibly leading to British planes not being able to land at European airports and running out of medical equipment and doctors and nurses and fleeing because they were no longer being able to work in London and Manchester. This, one could say, is perhaps an appropriate fate and destiny for this nation, London, Britain, England, that was a forerunner of the rise of capitalism, a pioneer in the African slave trade, and now perhaps coming to an ignominious end.
They got there first, just like, you know, the way they mentioned various things that have happened to the United States, for example, on the world stage as, well, this is going to happen to everyone, but because of the level of development, you got there first. Well, Britain was the first real major global colonial power. And if this is what's at the end of the line for them, then they would probably get there first or in the top three. We win place or show anyway.
Well, I'm afraid so. And, you know, it's very interesting that U.S. imperialism, of course, wants to take advantage of Brexit, the British exit from the European Union. That is to say, the original plan, it seems to me, that after Brexit in June 2016, London and the Conservatives, particularly Boris Johnson, the recently defrocked Foreign Secretary, had this idea of being sort of the companion, comrade of U.S. imperialism as a spear pointed at Germany and pointed at the European Union generally. But in some ways, Donald Trump has sort of mucked up that grand strategy with his recent trip to London and his praise of Boris Johnson, by the way,
right,
which has undermined Theresa May, the current prime minister. And in any case, the millions on the streets of London protesting his presence is going to make it very difficult for even a Boris Johnson as prime minister to execute that nefarious plan of having Britain act as a cat's paw on the European continent for U.S. imperialism.
Yeah, there's definitely some major contradictions that follow Trump's visit to London in terms of the impact on just that whole process. So we're out of time, but Dr. Horn, we really appreciate your time and look forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. On this edition of Crosstalk, we consider one question. Is Donald Trump's America First policy in contradiction to the Washington consensus idea of American exceptionalism? The answer to this question will likely define Trump's presidency and change the world in the process. Crosstalking American Exceptionalism. I'm joined by my guest, Michael Flanagan, in Washington. He is president of Flanagan Consulting and a former congressman. In Charlottesville, we have David Swanson. He is the director of worldbeyondwar.org. And in Northwood, we cross to Inderjit Palmar. He is a professor of international politics at City University, London. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules. In effect, that means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to David first, because he's written a book on the topic titled Curing Exceptionalism. Okay, we have about a year and a half of this presidency. I'm getting a pretty good idea what America First means in the mind of Donald Trump. And I know very well what American exceptionalism is. And I'm not a big proponent of it. Is Donald Trump incompatible with his American First policies with Washington's insistence and digging their heels in very deep that American exceptionalism must be maintained? Go ahead, David, in Charlottesville.
I guess the short answer is no, I don't see it. I look at what Donald Trump does in terms of foreign policy, in terms of continuing U.S. imperialism, and he is dropping more bombs, he is building more bases, he is getting more military spending out of Congress, demanding more military spending out of Europe, shipping weapons to more places, including Ukraine, continuing to insist on the U.S. right to do what it wants in places like Ukraine and Nicaragua. And around the world, he's not switching policies, allowing the people of Afghanistan or Nicaragua or anywhere else to decide their own fate. I mean, the changes are all rhetorical and in terms of mannerisms and style. People in People abroad outside the United States who see him as radically different because he blurts out things he doesn't act on, like NATO is obsolete, seems to me as superficial as people within the United States who say the vote in Crimea to rejoin Russia was the big threat to peace and stability and the rule of law of the past centuries. Looking at actions rather than at statements. I don't see it. He's continuing U.S. policy.
Good points made there. Michael, nonetheless, we have the reaction of where you are, the epicenter of the swamp. They see Trump as being very much a threat to the outlook that has been cultivated and enforced, I would point out, since the end of the Second World War, particularly since the end of the Cold War. So, I mean, Michael is right on all these points here, but that's not how the people that used to run the show see it that way, and they're pushing back against him in very peculiar ways, and particularly using the media to push against him. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think the swamp has a collectivist view. It definitely denies American exceptionalism writ small, and that is America has the best workers in the world, and we have an exceptional view of our future, and we view ourselves as the shining light of the world. And then you have American exceptionalism writ large, which, as a matter of foreign policy, means that we'll run the world. I think writ small, Trump is a huge champion of that. Writ large, I think your other guest is correct. He's not a big champion of America run the world in the sense that we will make foreign policy for the world, but we will behave any way we need to protect our security, and that is often irrespective of what Nicaragua wants or what anybody else wants. And I think Trump is definitely a proponent of that. The swamp would rather have us collectively sit with the European powers, basically, Europe almost exclusively, and discuss what we need to do around the world while we pay the freight and they make the decisions. And I think Trump is trying to bring an end to that by threatening NATO, not as an institution like Eisenhower did, by the way, in his presidency,
yep,
but to say that it's not an organization that we're going to support exclusively and move on forward with.
Interesting, combined of what we've just heard from Michael and David. So America first and American exceptionalism, they've defined the worst possible elements of both, and they're being combined. That's what I've gotten from this conversation so far. Go ahead, in Norwood, Northwood.
I don't think I would violently disagree with the two colleagues that you've just spoken with. I think American exceptionalism is a particular kind of nationalism, and that nationalism has attached to it a great sense of a uniqueness and superiority. And to a large degree, it's also backed by power. But it's power behind certain kinds of values. And I think where President Trump probably differs from his predecessors, like President Obama and George W. Bush as well, is that in a way he's rejected the rhetoric of values, of democracy, of human rights, and promoting those kinds of liberal values in favor of naked power. So I would say that that's the principal difference between those two. There is also a strategic disagreement as well. And I think that largely is around the relationship that the United States or President Trump is building with Russia and the bigger geopolitical picture, I think, which he has in his mind, possibly urged by Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State, about some kind of a possible Russian-Chinese split. And I think there's a big disagreement about that, but that's a strategic question. I think overall, the United States continues to exert its power, but I think the rhetoric around values, I think President Trump doesn't have any time for that. He's much more about asserting raw, hard power of the dollar, of the trade market access, and of the American military.
Okay, well, David, I mean, I guess in a way, Trump is probably more honest than his predecessors because he doesn't talk about democracy promotion but that has always been a cover. I think only people in the swamp actually believe in that rhetoric anymore, forcefully bringing democracy to the world. I don't see where it works. No one's ever empirically proven it to me. But so really, it's the same thing. It's American exceptionalism with a different rhetoric. I guess, that makes a lot of sense. Go ahead, David.
That's exactly right. The rhetoric has changed a lot more than the substance. The disagreement between the Make America Great Again people and the America Already Is Great people is not around the need for the United States to have double standards and a set of laws only for itself and superiority to the rest of the world. That is universally agreed upon in Washington. The disagreements are around rhetoric, around domestic policies, and around Russia and the demand from the Democrats. I wouldn't dignify it by calling it strategic. It's more trying to explain Hillary Clinton's loss and hating anything Trump does. So if he threatens North Korea, that's crazy. If he fails to threaten Russia, that's crazy. You know, the disagreement is around this mythical story of the evil deeds of Russia and their gargantuan significance in the context of the good U.S. law-abiding behavior. And there, you know, you can give Trump credit for refusing to bow to the Russia gators. Otherwise, I give him very little credit for anything thus far as he continues disastrous policies that are taking this country and the rest of the world over a cliff.
You know, the rhetoric is certainly different, but and some of the actions are too. I mean, I don't think any of us really took seriously that there would be a meeting with Kim so soon. Nothing much came of it, and now he wants to meet with the Iranian leader days before, in capital letters on Twitter, threatening it. I mean, Michael, how do you explain that? Or is that just expediency, the midterms? It's just the here and now, and worry about the implications later. Because I mean, from the outside looking in, this is very confusing. And we're supposed to be experts to be able to figure this stuff out. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think one of the hallmarks of Trump's foreign policy is that it's Trump. It's not a collective view of the State Department and with weigh-ins from DOD and other places and intelligence. It's Trump. And he's proven to be fairly adept at it so far. However, you may or may like the outcomes, he's gotten in with Korea. He's reworked trade agreements in Europe and elsewhere. Some of it has been to our total benefit. Some of it has been a conciliatory benefit. We enjoy a relationship with China we haven't had in maybe ever. I don't know that what he's doing is confusing bad, evil, wrong, or fattening, but what I do know is that it's in his head and it's been working thus far on the talking diplomatic level. And so I'm not prepared to throw it over just because I don't understand it.
No, I get your point, which
I don't understand.
I get your point. Yeah, I get your point. I mean, the way he sees the world here and his base. And I think, let me go back to Northwood here. It seems to me, even a year and a half in, Donald Trump doesn't have a lot of interest in foreign policy. He's made a group of promises on the stump, and he's committed to realizing each one of them. I've never seen it, a president so adamant going through his checklist, okay? Is it really his idea of American exceptionalism, American first? Is it really domestic politics driving it for him?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there is a very, very great interest in domestic politics, and he has made a whole load of promises. And as you say, I think the first thing that Steve Bannon did when he entered the White House as his advisor was to put up a whiteboard and put a whole load of lists of the promises made and start ticking them off. But I think the foreign policy perspective that President Trump has is one of increasing American power and extracting as much value economically, commercially, financially, and so on from allies, associated powers, and from enemies. And I think all that is down to his long-term idea that America has been ripped off. Yeah. And I think if you look at domestic politics, then the kind of people he defines as core Americans, he basically is selling them the same message, that you have been ripped off, white American men in particular, by women, by minorities, by immigrants, and so on, and you've lost status. And what he's going to do is right. Restore American
okay.
greatness. And
okay, I'm going to jump in here,
American
gentlemen.
Male at home
American hard power
abroad.
I have a hard break
there
here.
There is a sort of...
After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on American exceptionalism. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, David, you know, ever since Trump entered the Oval Office, a lot of us have been trying to understand if there's a rhyme or reason to his foreign policy. And I think that even on this program, it's kind of coming together. It seems to me it's kind of like going back to the 19th century great powers competition without all the values that that were pushed since the Second World War. It's just really kind of brute power and advantage and looking for competitive advantage. And it's very brusque, and it seems to appeal, just as Inderjit pointed out to us in the first part of the program, it does appeal to his base. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I think, you know, it appears to be all Donald Trump. But just as, you know, Reagan and Gorbachev came out of the meeting and were told by their advisors, no, you can't get rid of nuclear weapons. Every time Trump has a good idea, like get rid of NAFTA or get rid of NATO, he talks to his advisors and it's off the table. I think that, you know, an actual break with U.S. exceptionalism is not on the agenda of Donald Trump or his advisors. I mean, it would look like joining the International Criminal Court, joining the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The United States is party to fewer major human rights treaties than almost any other nation on earth. It would mean giving up the veto at the United Nations. It would mean getting out of Afghanistan. There's a promise I'd like Trump to keep. I mean, this is a guy who promised no more of these wars and bomb their family, you know, kill their families, bomb the bleep out of them. So it's easy to say he's keeping his promise because he promised black and white. But the ones I'd like him to keep, he's not keeping, as well as, you know, a few like building the wall and locking up Hillary that I don't necessarily need him to keep either. But, you know, this is a guy who thinks he's running the world, and it's dangerous to what extent he is, but he's not overruling the weapons dealers or the big players in Washington, D.C.
You know, yeah, Michael, that seems to be very contradictory, because he said in interviews that the United States shouldn't be the policeman of the world, but in fact, it remains the same, okay? And particularly, you know, I mean, you look at the Korean Peninsula. I mean, a peace between the Koreas, denuclearization, maybe the American troops could go home. There'd be no reason for them to be there. And then the entire foreign policy elite has their hair on fire, like, oh, my God, peace, don't let it break out. It'll change our world, okay? I mean, it seems to me that he's just going really up against the stream there. And he keeps coming out with these ideas. I mean, you know, like I said earlier, I mean, you know, threatening Iran in the most coarse way. And then say, oh, I'd like to meet with no condition, preconditions. I mean, the outside looking in finds that very, very confusing. I mean, the Iranians have already said through their aides is that why would we sit down with someone that broke a country that broke a treaty that we just signed only a few years ago? I mean, how does that show the America leading? Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a treaty, and they didn't sign anything. But that's a semantic problem
Iranians. It's an international agreed. I mean, it's multilateral. It wasn't just with the Americans. Okay, go ahead.
But I think the point you're making is good, and it's correct. But it stops, and I think that's what we have to focus on, is that the goals, his foreign policy goals, are, as the professor correctly observed, although I think for reasons different than he observes them, and that is that we are interested in better trade, we are interested in exercising our trade power, and to increase American presence and wealth at home, American exceptionalism, America first, through trade treaties, through trade work, as opposed to naked aggression and use of foreign power, which other presidents have used. Obama was soundly criticized on the right for wanting to meet with the Iranians with no preconditions. I find it interesting that my brothers on the right don't have a problem with Trump doing the same thing. I just throw that out as an observation.
Hang on, Michael. I mean, the same week, basically threatening hostilities with Iran and then saying you want to meet with preconditions. You don't have to worry about your friends on the left or right. You have to try to figure out what the president is talking about. Okay, that's my point. Okay.
Well, this was the same No, your point is right. But this is the same tactic we took with North Korea. You know, little Kim, Rocket Man, blah, blah, blah. You know, terrible person, going to blow you off the face of the earth. You're going to blow us off the face of the earth. Next thing you know, we're meeting in Singapore. This is the art of the deal. This is a part of the tactics of moving forward. This is part of the noise involved in making the deal, in making the negotiation and doing the work. And it's Trump. He's unique. He is rare. He is something we haven't seen before. The swamp can't make head or tail out of him, and nor can anyone else. And this goes back to my earlier point, which was just buckle up, just as you've observed many times, Peter, buckle up, and you're just going to have to wait to see how it boils out. And the swamp will do their best to keep their arm around it. I just don't know how it's going to work out.
Okay, brace for impact. Okay, Inderjeet, let me go back to you here. Yeah. So what is the justification for the United States being in Afghanistan? It's not bringing democracy there anymore, apparently. What's the justification for the illegal behavior of the United States in Syria? Is it bringing democracy there anymore? It's not, apparently. So why are they still there? See, I mean, this makes it very patently obvious. It's just brute force beyond international law. This is what Trump is opening up to. Go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, when we look at the big picture of global change, we have a whole range of new emerging powers, some of which are very, very powerful economically and increasingly powerful militarily. And they're looking around the world for resources, and they're looking to increase their influence in order to protect their lines of communication. China, for example, is building the One Belt, One Road initiative, which is going to be kind of right across from China all the way to Spain and in through the Indian Ocean. You've got non-state actors like ISIS and other organizations also challenging and destabilizing allies and other regimes as well. And I think what really President Trump is trying to do is effectively grapple with the same problem which post-Cold War presidents have tried to outline, which is the whole world environment has changed. The big difference, I think, with President Trump is he doesn't really look at the idea of hegemony, of building an orderly system or an ordered rules-based system, or rather he wants to open it up, he wants to loosen it up, and he wants to make it more transactional. So I think what he's trying to do is say, look, we've got this big international series of regimes. America's been ripped off. It's paying too much. It has too many large deficits with everybody. And what we're going to do is we're going to flex our national strength and try to renegotiate our position within it and effectively subordinate everybody else.
Okay.
And
well,
that's actually the big grand plan.
Okay. Well, again, like I said, it looks like it's going back to the great powers of the 19th century without all of the rhetoric. At least it's more transparent. David, you mentioned Russia. Is it really worth it for Trump to go down this path? We had the Helsinki summit. I was critical of the president's delivery at the press conference, like I was in Singapore as well. It's not his forte. He's got to work on his game there. And then he wanted another summit and then walked it back. The Russians invited him to Moscow. Why is this so important to him? Is it a campaign promise, or is it just, you know, the media hates it when he does it, and that he just pushes back to show that I am president and I'm going to do what I want to do? Well, what is his fascination here? Go ahead, David.
Well, I think there is all kinds of pressure on him to meet with and work with Russia and to not do so and to treat Russia as having attacked the United States and started a war and to engage in war with Russia and everywhere in between. I think that it's appropriate that the United States and Russia, as the major nuclear weapons powers, meet and get rid of those damn things before they destroy us. I think it's critical for the United States and Russia, as two of the nations doing the most to destroy our natural environment, to meet and start reversing those policies.
David,
that's not so much of the agenda. Maybe
I'm in complete agreement with you, and I'm going to stay with David here.
Yeah.
Why? It seems to me that Trump's engagement with Russia should come out very clear. Twitter is fine with me. I need to deal with Vladimir Putin to sign a new arms control agreement. It's about to expire in 2021. This is what's most important to all of humanity. Why can't he just write that? I mean, that is very straightforward. And you know what, David? It's transactional, what Trump is supposed to be all about. Go ahead, David.
Well, it would make perfect sense. It would fit with some of his agenda, but it is not where he comes from. It's not something he knows anything about. It's not something he's hired anybody to keep around him who would advise him to do. And it's, you know, he's got the U.S. media and the Democrats and half the public screaming at him not to do anything cooperative with Russia, even if it kills us all.
Yeah.
So it's not shocking that he hasn't come out with that position. But he should. He damn well should. And the world and Russia should be pushing him in that direction.
Okay. All right. Michael, I mean, where does he go from this, from his Russia gambit now? I mean, he's put it off until next year. Is that because of the midterms? It's because he can't do anything transactional? Because just like David said, perfect, crystal clear, even trying to save humanity, he's the boogeyman. Donald Trump is evil incarnate, even if he wants to save humanity. That's a problem in the United States. That's a problem with American exceptionalism. 40 seconds to you, Michael, my friend. Last word.
Real quick, and I promise to stay inside my time slot. Trump never telegraphs what he's going to do. He'll make promises in a campaign context. He'll allude to things in a domestic policy context, but he's never going to say up front what he's going to do. It's one of his huge criticisms of his predecessors. And so because he hasn't said it's there, doesn't mean it's not going to be there. And he's had some surprises for him policy-wise of stuff no one expected, but it was always part of his design. And I think that we just have to buckle up and wait.
Well, you know, that's why I call you one of my Donald Trump Sherpers. That was a very good answer. I like that. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, Charlottesville, and in Northwood. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.